You're listening to Adam's Motion and the Void. It was nearing midnight. I was just left off from a meeting with Arthur Battlebane in the alley, a place I felt sure I would come to know over the coming years. Battlebane, following the plotline of his own play, Mistrigiel, proposed a place trading, a la the Prince and the Pauper. Not only had he offered to take over my role in the play, but my role in life as well. The exchange was, I suppose, meant to be mutual, as he would become Show and Sleeves. I would become Arthur Battlebane. But whereas he had, over the course of any number of weeks, made an intimate study of my peculiar person, my habits and manner, watching me in secret, on my way here and there, and from the shadows of my apartment, and could mount a sufficiently accurate campaign, I knew very little about him. He was a well-known and very highly esteemed playwright, about 15 years my junior. He was mercurial in manner, and, if I could judge by this experiment, playful to the extreme in matters of identity and reality. I was not sure at all how I would handle his portrayal, or even if I would, or for that matter, whether it was necessary. Might I not just use this time as a kind of taking of the waters? I was thus now returning to Claridge House at 70 Windsor Street, his residence, as he was returning to mine. In my pocket was his heavy key set. In his pocket, mine. The contrast in our styles of living should be quickly noted. He was wealthy, and I was not. He lived in a penthouse in the priciest part of town, and I lived in a rented room in the shabbiest neighborhood still within the city limits. The offer to exchange had an indulgently expansive option that would permit me to divest myself of my own hat, as it were, into perpetuity, if I so chose. I might never be Show and Sleeves again, if it was my want. I took this offer lightly at first. I laughed, in fact, when he said it. So madcap a concept had no real result in my mind. But as I walked along the nighttime street, and the buildings grew nicer, cleaner, more beautifully lit, I recalled B.B.'s hard look, how he reiterated that he was deadly serious with the offer, and that I must believe him. "It's important, Sherwin," Battlebane said, "that you be perfectly confident in the reliability of my offer. I do not joke. If you so desire, you may walk away from this developed construction, this allied contraption you call Sherwin's Sleeves. And you will continue to play me," I said, smiling. B.B. frowned. "Please," he said, "accept my offer as real. There is not a shred of humor in it." "Fine," I said, though I was rather putting the conversation to bed than finding any sympathy with his request. There was some comic, surrealist satisfaction in the thought that at that moment I was walking home. And by that I meant Battlebane. That he was striding with my gait, hands in pockets, overly aware of his posture, down my rotten street, in the best imitation imaginable. If he was doing it right, you would be glancing in all the lit-up close-by windows, as I've always enjoyed peeking in at other people's lives. Shortly, as myself, he would be unlocking my door, stepping into the cold kitchen, and if he was the expert he claimed, instead of removing his coats and hat, without turning on the light, he would set down at the table with the old green glass bottle he parlayed at the alley, and pour himself a nightcap. Then would jacket and coat be hastened to their hook and nook, followed by another nightcap at the little roost of the sitting-room window. Still, he should not be using any lamp or light, by moonlight only, as I found peace in darkness. One arm on the sill, leaning now and then forward, to keep an eye on the curious mix of drunken stragglers and strangely sober pedestrians on the dark, gaslit street below, and then gazing up at the scraggling silhouette of the city against the lovely star-filled sky. Would he do all these things, I wondered, all my struggling back and forths? And then another thought. Why did I?
Rock my boat, cold waves sway amid the mist of the burial lake.
I had no obligation to follow my own rituals, complete my own chores, but yet I would still, via Beryl Bain's conveying performance, be credited with them. In this way, I saw that being show in sleeves was nothing but a type of complicated employment, not much different than working for a company. In this case, the company manufactured and kept up the appearance and compacted foible of my personality. In Beryl Bain's substitution, I was being given the chance for a kind of sabbatical, yet while also being provided with the perfect alibi, as my chair at my desk at the office of myself was being filled and my work completed. I was being maintained up close by a warm body, a receptacle for my title indeed, but was yet here far away, and through this contrast I felt a remarkable sense of dissolution, as though I were becoming with every step increasingly a ghost. That this was an advanced form of disappearance, as on some level I was registering here and there and no place. All my old debts were cancelled, all my old ways and habits, my props and gimmicks, were out the door, and on loan to him. It was very nice to go over the hardships of my day, and then release them into Battlebane's custody. Even waking in the morning carried with it the cold cock of despair. My eyes woke to the unknown, and then quickly dimmed to the dungeon fact of the bad news of my being. Oh, this again, I felt. Oh, me again. Oh, my life. The whole thing laid out before me like a miserable movie I hope never to see again. Same old room, same old bed, same old scenes, conversations, commute, meals, day. Same old clothes, same old shoes, same old wallet on the bureau, and the watch to clack it on, with the time clicking away, and not a single moment warmly regarded. My bed was overly soft and lumpen, and ruined my back each night. In some measure, I felt that I'd just handed over to Battlebane my racked spinal column. I was never prepared for breakfast either. Rubbing my eyes, fingering a hole-filled sock from under the bedskirt, I'd stagger into the cold kitchen, heat up some old toast, scrape down some dirty-looking butter and some hard jam, and maybe, if I was feeling energetic, I'd put the kettle on and make a mongrel cup of army ration coffee. My poorly stocked pantry was thus rendered unto him as well. I laughed. He could have my bad back, my bad breakfast, my bad coffee, my stale cracker, fish soup pantry. I was smiling in the night, walking along his beautiful avenues. I was beaming. Take that, I felt, as though Battlebane and I had engaged in some elaborate chess game, and he had lost. And now here we were, victory and loss heading home to their prizes. I slowed my pace. Battlebane walked with his hands behind his bad back, like a Hasidim. He looked downward and with philosophy, his eyes cold pressing that day's excrescence of pedestrian oil from the air, from the sidewalks, as though his mind were dribbling this all into a mortar of a million thoughts, and then reconstituting a great and single theorem, some epigrammatically ineffable explanation of mankind. I don't know why, but somehow I manufactured in my mind a necessary asymmetrical balance that in the justice of larger workings, whatever was rotten in my own personal Denmark would be unrotten in his. My expectation was that the bed awaiting me at my penthouse suite at Claridge Place would be the exact right bed for me, the king of all possible beds, that no expert in the world and no long method of pursued discovery could bring such a mattress to my spine, that his pantry would be stocked with the things I loved but eschewed for an inherited parsimony. No stale crackers, no cheap tin fish soup, none of the second and third-rate ration food I'd built my flesh with. His coffee, best of all, would be a chocolatish elixir, so spot-hitting and contagious I would never be able to stop drinking it. I slowed myself at Windsor Street, wanting to savour more of these imaginings before any material form could bring me down. How awful it was to be me, how wonderful to be him. I decided in a fool's wind, and just for the pleasuring purpose, to give myself over most fully to the notion of our switching lives. The freedom of the concept, at the very least, would provide me with the sort of deep, cathartic exhalation provided by a very enthralling book. I would pretend, but in committing to the fancy at an atomic level, I would forget I was pretending. With this tidal shift, this suspension of my disbelief, I felt an even greater rush of release, as though the creaking door of the world, in all its glory, suddenly opened for me again. A fruited offering in all directions, a type of paradise was at hand, and I was shooting toward it. The great glass door of Claridge House was locked. I fumbled for the largest key, thinking its grandness bespoke its higher function. Then, down through the six other keys I rattled, until I discovered, unpleasantly, that the very smallest key, the one I'd taken for a briefcase or luggage key, fit and worked. In the main foyer was a greenly lit sign-in desk. During the day, this station, I knew, was occupied by a top-hatted doorman. There was a swirling marble staircase behind the desk that rose into the expensive darkness, and to my left, the narrow door of an elevator, which I soon learned itself required a key. Having gained some knowledge from the front door, I used the second smallest key and found success. Battlebane lived on the 10th floor, the penthouse suite. I maintained my philosophical, ascetic position, hands behind back, imagining myself returning home after another much too terribly good night. I was quite warmly fuzzed with my imaginary portrayal, but as the elevator dinged open upon my suite, I was struck dumb to see a pretty young woman in the low light, seated by my door, sleeping, in fact, on one of the great oak chairs that stood on either side of the large entry. Flowers crested from her hand, and there was a wine bottle wrapped in silk by her foot on the floor. The elevator door closed on me, and I leaned to push the button that would show it all to me again.
To do, to do, to do some more. To je, to do some more. Comme ça. La vie, c'est épatant. To do, to do, to do some more. To je, to do some more. Comme ça. La vie, je la comprends. N'allez jamais trop vite, vous aurez tout le temps. Attention à la dynamite. Prenez garde au volcan, à ces jeunes énervés qui ne savent pas aller. To do some more, comme ça, à flânant gentiment. N'allez jamais trop vite, en un mot simplement, pour avoir de la réussite. Soyez très très prudent, l'amour ne viendra, c'est blottir dans vos bois.
I stepped toward the girl in growing trepidation. She was likely one of Battlebane's literary groupies, come calling with the hopes of spending an illuminating evening in his featured presence, with the obvious promise of something more intimate. I stood before the young woman and rattled my keys, rather like an animal or someone who has never once had a strange experience and knows not what else to do but to stamp around and make a loud show. I briefly sorted myself to the third smallest key, thinking to keep things going in their wrong-headed order. I thrashed the keys once more, both loudly and timidly, and then trounced them with antagonism before the girl's sleeping face, and, quite by accident, dropped them on the hard floor, where they smashed with the sound of broken glass. I apologized as I leaned to pick them up, but the girl was either fishing for my touch by pretending to be asleep, to catch me with an initially established fleshly contact, or had previously engaged with the wine. "Madam," I said, trying to hit my vocatives as Battlebane, "I will not be touching you. Thus, if you are awake to appreciate this notion, you may simply pretend now to wake up and put this starry game behind you." Nevertheless, and almost while saying this, I jostled at her shoulder with the scroll of my hand. She did not stir, excepting that her head tipped forward at my stimulation, as though she were now even more deeply inspired for sleep. Having created the dreamy possibility that it was all an act on her part, designed to get me, as Battlebane, to more intimately or generally touch her. In fact, I now assumed she wished that I carry her across the threshold. There could be no doubt she was a siren, luring Battlebane into her trap. I leaned down, lifted the wine bottle from the floor, removed the flowers from her hand, and said, "Thank you kindly for your presence. You may go." I inserted the third smallest key into the suite door and stepped inside. "Aha," I said to myself, as this was something Bibi said upon entering my dressing room after the show had ended. I was fumbling through the darkness toward the far kitchen, where a spindling nightlight offered the only illumination. If show and sleeves went directly to the kitchen in his coat and hat, then according to my theory of contrary worlds, Archibald Bane, despite his present blindness in the room, would unclothe at the first moment. Also, where my predilection would keep the room dark, I reluctantly painted my hand back over the wall, searching for the light switch. To my relief, I found none. I took off my hat and dropped it to a side, and let my coat slough off to the floor. Indeed, I fancied that Archibald Bane, unlike myself, was not fastidious, was in fact a very messy man, who yet had a girl or two, or a larger staff, come gusting in every afternoon to pick up after him. Scrupulously clean in person, well perfumed and with excellently kept and tailored clothing, he was uncontrollably lazy regarding the material world. Still, with his money and requirements, his world would be kept in perfect manicure. This was all, of course, directly in opposition to my own experience. I knew Beryl Bane to be a fine dresser, who smelled nicely of eau de cologne, but I did not know in any way that he was a messy person. This simply again followed my interest, and perhaps hope, to fly in reverse of my own tendency. I kept a very spare home, and yet was rather unclean in person. I showered or bathed once a week, exerted myself as mildly as I might, so not to build up any decayable sweat, and assumed that that was enough. Although once in the kitchen I could not find a light switch, I did find a candle and a set of matches. Show in sleeves is not a candle person, therefore Beryl Bane was. After lighting two waxy stubs and smudging them into place in the kitchen peripheries, I quickly found a bottle opener and a nice aperitif glass. I poured myself some of the silk-wrapped wine, having almost completely forgotten who'd provided it. Just to check my own theory of the groupie girl, I quietly popped my head out the door and gazed into the dark hall. I assumed, and was pleased to see, that my night visitor was gone. I was just closing the door when I noticed in the shadows near the stair railing, about 5 feet off, a pale leg. I looked back at the bench. The wine bottle was still on the floor, and then, in my adjustments, I realized that the girl had slumped forward off the bench and then rolled once into the rails. A large movement for an invalid, but possible. I shut the door swiftly and froze. Scurrying half-thoughts appeared in the scar of my mind. She's dead. No, she's just drunk. Beryl Bane has killed her, and now I'm to be held to account. No, she's just drunk. The police are on their way now. She's committed suicide, and now you'll take the fall, because she's dead. I should throw her in the river. I could take her to the hospital. Just leave her. I should wear gloves. Did I touch her already? What about the wine? The flowers? I could buy a new bottle. Wear gloves. I opened the door, walked back into the hall, placed the flesh of my fingers to her neck. If she was cold, if there was no heartbeat, I would call for the police immediately. I was surprised, in the shifting perspective as I bent over her, to notice that she was not young at all. There were some soft folds under her eyes, and a small sag of skin at her neck. She was, perhaps, like Beryl Bane himself, in her early 50s. I put my fingers to her throat, and waited for the favoring reply of a pulse. Listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.